Hello and welcome to Behind the Health Statistic. My name is Lara Kaup and I'm a lecturer at Cardiff University School of Healthcare Sciences. In this episode of the Women's Health series, I'll be speaking to Dee. Dee is the engagement officer at the patient-led female health equality charity Fair Treatment for the Women of Wales, and has lived experience of adenomyosis, stage 4 endometriosis, ME, fibromyalgia and asthma. She is currently studying an MA in creative writing at Cardiff Met, writing about grief in many forms. In this episode, Dee will be sharing her experience of adenomyosis. Adenomyosis is defined as the presence of endometrial glands that appear within the tissues in the muscle of the uterus. The old tissue and blood cannot get out of the muscle and flow out of the cervix. The blood and tissue saturate the site, swelling and causing intense pain in the form of menstrual cramps. The strength and intensity of these changes as the condition develops. At worst, it has been described as feeling like sudden labour pains or the feeling of a weight pressing down on the bladder and bowel. Monthly uterine bleeding is often heavy, as some of the blood finally escapes the muscle and results in prolonged spotting to the point, in the worst case, of anemia and low iron store levels. It is often misdiagnosed as fibroids and can appear with other conditions such as ovarian cysts, prolapse, and even gynecological cancers that can cause pelvic pain. Adenomyosis affects as many as 1 in 10 women of reproductive age. It is more common in women aged 40 to 50 years and who have had children. However, in recent years, women in their late teens and early 20s are being diagnosed far sooner. So let's go over to the conversation with Dee. Hi Dee, thanks for speaking with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lara.
Oh, you're very welcome. So you've agreed to talk to me about some of your health conditions, your experiences of women's health services in particular. So I just wanted to start with one of your conditions, which is adenomyosis, which I hadn't heard of myself until about 12 months ago.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you could explain to our listeners, what is adenomyosis?
Sure. So adenomyosis happens when the endometrium, so the lining of the womb, is found deep in the myometrium. So that's the muscle of the uterus. So if we know a little bit about endometriosis, which is where cells similar to the lining of the womb are found elsewhere in the body, adenomyosis is actually the lining of the womb itself penetrating into the muscle wall, if you like, of the womb. So yeah, that's the basic definition, I think. I hope that conveys sort of how it can feel a little bit as well. So
yeah, well, you know, maybe we could talk about that. If you wouldn't mind telling us about your journey to your diagnosis.
Sure.
And within that, you could tell us about the symptoms that you experienced or how it presented for you.
Sure. So I was quite convinced from quite a young age that I had endometriosis. I'm like a lot of patients who have never heard of adenomyosis. There's no page on like the main NHS website about adenomyosis. It's mentioned sort of, I think, as part of endometriosis. So it's often seen as like the same thing. So my journey to be diagnosed with endometriosis from the onset of my symptoms took 23 years, during which time I had 2 laparoscopies with general gynae and was told there was nothing wrong. So it was quite a lengthy traumatic process. And for me, and I think this is probably similar for a lot of adenomyosis patients as well, that adenomyosis diagnosis and treatment came at the end of that experience. So it's almost like, you know, you sort of rule out everything else, and then when you get, oh well, it might be that. And that's kind of understandable. Like I say, I don't think there's enough awareness among the general public and patients, but also healthcare professionals as well. Symptoms-wise, again, the symptoms can really mimic endometriosis. There's a lot of crossover. But I think it was interesting before I sort of came to talk to you today, it was, I thought, oh, well, I'll have a look, because I had a hysterectomy last year, so sort of 18 months ago. So my adenomyosis is no more, it is gone. Hooray. but yeah, sort of looking back on the symptoms, again, like the sort of short information I could find on any sort of NHS Trust, you know, site was, you know, a couple of symptoms. We were talking, you know, heavy, painful or irregular periods, maybe bowel pain. They talk about pain during or after intercourse. But actually, there was a heck of a lot more to it than that. So I had a coil fitted. So when I was on my second coil, that was, you know, so I had two sort of coils in a row. And for them, they actually stopped my bleeding for much of it. So although the first coil I had was amazing, like no symptoms, I was like, party time for 5 years, just feeling like this healthy person. And then, yeah, my second coil unfortunately wasn't as successful. However, it did sort of stop my bleeding. So in terms of like heavy bleeding, that wasn't a thing for me. When I did have what I still call periods, there wasn't really any bleeding there. It was more the other symptoms. So yeah, I mean, like, a lot of pain. So when we're looking at adenomyosis in particular, we're talking, you know, that pelvic pain, you will feel like cramps. So central to your abdomen, essentially, so where your uterus is, that will cramp. And they can be really similar, if not worse, a lot of patients say, than the contractions of childbirth, you know, being in labor. So we're talking really severe pain here. But for me, I think, yeah, the heaviness, the discomfort in my pelvis, it felt like I was carrying like a really heavy bowling ball within my body. It was quite challenging to sort of feel like going around doing your day-to-day business, feeling like you're carrying this big weight that you just kind of want to push. But yeah, like, you know, we know about patients certainly know about endobelly. We talk about the bloating and the pain and things like that. So that's also a symptom. What I found as well was a lot of bowel pain and a lot of bowel symptoms. So at the same time, I should state I did have stage 4 endometriosis that was infiltrating my bowel and my bladder. So I had bowel and bladder pain symptoms. So I would have... you know, feeling like I needed to go to the toilet all the time in terms of like UTI-like symptoms, but also things like constipation, diarrhea, a lot of pain when going to the toilet. So that was difficult. But yeah, things that aren't really sort of talked about with adenomyosis would be like nausea, acid reflux, things like that. It feels like there's just this something going on in your body, like centrally, you know, this whole sort of explosion, it just feels like it impacts on you completely. Before I had my hysterectomy, in sort of the couple of months before it, I had migraine symptoms every single day. I would, you know, when I lay down to go to sleep, I would have heartburn, acid reflux, I'd feel nauseous a lot of the time. And yeah, like I had endobelly every single day. I would often wake up looking relatively, you know, normal as I would, you know, before all of this kicked off. And then by the time I got home from work, usually I'd have to like take off all of my work clothes. I was wearing like maternity tights and maternity clothes and still had to take them all off because they were digging into my tummy. So it was really quite extreme. But again, I think the thing that isn't really discussed is the fatigue. For a lot of patients, they will have such debilitating fatigue. And like for me, I was still trying to work full time. I was playing sport. I was trying to socialize and it all just kind of blew up. I'd work full time and then get home and just go to sleep and like I just didn't have a life really outside of working. And on the weekends, I would just be stuck in bed in pain and with fatigue, but also like the pain being so much that I couldn't get to sleep. So, you know, there was like a whole list of symptoms really. And I think for me, when I woke up from my hysterectomy, despite having had excision surgery for the endometriosis at the same time, so a lot of, you know, stuff being moved around and things like that, despite being catheterized because of having, you know, the uterus removed, I woke up and just felt like amazing. Like my pelvic area was free and it was like, oh my goodness, like such a relief, you know. And then, yeah, like walking out of the hospital the next day, I was like, oh God, you know, I just feel like I'm walking regularly. You know, there was that weight that was in my pelvis had just completely gone. So yeah, that was quite magic.
Yeah. And so I was, you know, you said it took 23 years to get to that point. That's a heck of a long time.
Yeah. So my symptoms started as soon as my periods did when I was 12. I remember my first period and like sort of going to the toilet and looking down and being like, whoa, like, what's this, you know? So I didn't really have sort of any telltale signs up to that. But yeah, like just remember, you know, like when you look back to your childhood home and you have like memories of your childhood home. Yeah, a lot of mine are being in bed, crawling on the floor, like to get to the bathroom, vomiting, a lot of diarrhea. I think because of how things are, like, you know, the taboo and all of that, like my mum had really painful periods and heavy periods, and she had fatigue often and things like that. And nothing was ever sort of discussed about that. You know, I think I remember saying to her, like, it's so painful. And she said, oh, it's just the way it is. Like, and I remember her saying, like, the women in our family do tend to have a lot of pain. And it was like, okay, so you just sort of dismiss it. And I think then, you know, talking to friends at school as things sort of progressed, it was like, couple of them, you know, we're talking when they were like 14, 15, had already been put on the pill to help with their pain and things like that. And for whatever reason, that wasn't something I wanted to do. But yeah, by the time I was 16, I was like, right, whatever you've got, throw it at me kind of thing. So that was sort of where the journey started at 16. And unfortunately, yeah, it was just tried contraceptive pill after contraceptive pill. I later found out that some of the reactions I'd had to those pills, I should never have been like carried on with any of them because I was having like migraines with aura and things like that. So there was real risk to my health. Yeah. I often like when I'm sat here talking about this stuff, I think, how the heck am I still here? Because as well as like the mental health impact on me, I just think like a lot of the risk that I was put under by, you know, I loved my family GP. He was amazing. But, you know, you just think because there wasn't like the nice guidance at the time, you know, that wasn't there. And all of these things, I just think, gosh, you know, he's really put me through the mill on all of those sort of treatments. I mean, I was still on the pill by the time I got to university. That was where I had my first laparoscopy. That was a nightmare. Like, I don't remember a great deal except for like, no, the surgery team didn't come and see me after that surgery. So this is something I would love to like implore upon, you know, any healthcare students listening to this, if they're going into that kind of surgery, is actually have a conversation, but also like share like some notes with your patient when you go and see them after surgery, because we're like really high as a kite, you know? So if we do have that visit, you know, they'll tell us stuff and half the time we don't even remember it, but then you might not see them then for months, so you have that like trauma then of thinking, well, what on earth happened? But yeah, so nobody came to see me. I was told at some point that they had found scar tissue on my pouch of Douglas. I didn't even know what that was. I was like, okay. And then a nurse came to see me and said, you can go home now. And I was like, oh, okay. And I said, so what happens next? Like, what do I do kind of thing? And she was like, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, well, what's going to happen like with my periods? Are they going to be like less painful and stuff like that? Like, I don't know what to expect because I was so like ill-informed. And she looked at my notes and just went, well, you're on the pill. You shouldn't be having painful periods. And I was just gobsmacked. I thought, like, why do you think I'm here? Why do you think I've just had surgery at like 19 years old? Like, come on. So yeah, very strange. By the time I then had my follow-up appointment for that, was told that my notes had been lost. We talked about where my pain was. My pain was high up. So they said, that's your bowel, that's IBS. Completely dismissive. I said, like, I thought it might be endometriosis because of the scar tissue. Oh no, that was probably an infection. So that was like the dismissal I had at that point. And I just didn't have the skills to advocate for myself further. I didn't know what to do. I just, oh, okay, took their word for it. After that, I developed a codeine addiction because I was prescribed the strongest possible cocodamol, you know, codeine paracetamol mix by my GP, who gave me, I think it was like 2 months worth and just sent me off. So there was none of the, don't take this for longer than 3 days. He said, take 8 tablets, for, you know, throughout a 24-hour period. So take 2 tablets 4 times a day kind of thing. And I went off and did that and got a codeine addiction. It's like, oh my gosh. Barely functioned during sort of my second year of uni. Graduated with a 2-1, which I still don't know how that happened. But yeah, just sort of fast forward a few years and just sort of again, still struggling. Then saw a GP who was just like, so they said they found scar tissue. I was like, yeah, right, that's endometriosis as far as I'm concerned. You've got endometriosis. I was like, oh, validation. She fitted my first coil. She was amazing. However, still did not refer me to gynae. You know, it's like, so we're still having like this battle. Those were the 5 years of like great fun I had because my symptoms were like drastically reduced. Again, sort of fast forward a few years, I'd moved to Wales, was having real trouble getting my coil like replaced because it was causing me absolute agony and I just didn't really know why. No one seemed to know why, you know, it was, oh, you've got a tilted uterus. Another symptom of adenomyosis, folks, is a tilted uterus. So that was just seen as like this normal thing. Like I say, didn't really have much success on that second coil bar, sort of stopping bleeding, really. Sort of fast forward, saw another GP who was actually great, went in, I said, these are my symptoms. I think it's, you know, a recurrence of my endometriosis because I'd had that former GP. I was like, yes, you know. He referred me straight away to gynae. And then that's where the issues really started with my care. So every appointment I had with that gynae team, I saw somebody different. No notes were taken. Nobody ever sort of introduced themselves to me. Occasionally, I would see somebody who seemed to be quite on the ball and would say, yep, you know, and would send me off with something and say, right, try that, and then come back. And if that doesn't work, you know, we're going to book you in for a laparoscopy. So great. And then, you know, I would come back and then have to argue with somebody else because they would say, no, this is IBS, this is IBS, this is IBS. So, you know, all of the other symptoms I had were just completely ignored because I was saying, you know, I was having bowel pain and rectal bleeding and things like that. So, you know, it was always just it's IBS. So, yeah, that sort of culminated then. I argued with a consultant. That was when I'd really had enough, actually argued with her and basically said, I want a laparoscopy and somebody here has got to perform a laparoscopy on me. Just remember her being really like angry and writing down, right, you know, fine, we will do that, you know, and sent me off on my way. You'll get a letter and all of that. So had a laparoscopy, somebody came round to see me after that and said, good news, you haven't got an endometriosis, there's nothing there. So I was obviously high as a kite, like, what, you know, this has been going on for years, like, what the hell? And he was really mystified as to why I was, like, distressed, you know, because I was like, well, what the hell is wrong with me if it's, like, all of these symptoms, like, they're just like big neon arrows, and all of these healthcare professionals are like look closing their eyes and go, no, it's definitely not that. And I'm like, please, you know, just pay attention to my symptoms. So yeah, later on after that, so yeah, again, follow-up appointment, that was absolutely horrific. That was a real source of medical trauma. I was shouted at, just treated awfully. I was crying and he was just telling me to stop crying. You know, I was really getting on his nerves. That's not what you went to work for that day, was this crying woman, you know, being hysterical about these symptoms that, you know, weren't endometriosis. So I then said, because I'd obviously done this research as well and found the Adenomyosis Advice Association. So I was like, what about adenomyosis? Oh yeah, it's probably that. That was it. And I was like, okay, so what do we do about that? And I already knew, like, the cure for adenomyosis is hysterectomy. So I was like, okay, I'm willing at this point to accept that I might not have endometriosis, but that it's adeno. So yeah, great. What are we gonna do? And his response was, you've already got the coil. That's the best cure for adenomyosis. So again, really angry, dismissive, just ill-informed. I was like, oh. And then against my better judgment, I said, well, I can't feel my coil strings at the moment. Can you check that they're there, that it's still in place? So angry doctor then performed an angry, you know, examination of me that was really brutal. There was a nurse holding my hand. I was sobbing, and I'm generally not a crier unless I'm really angry. I am an angry crier. But yeah, I was sobbing, just complete distress. And literally his tone was, I'm sorry if this is hurting you. I'm sorry you're upset. There was no like emotion there. There was no, do you need me to stop or anything like that? So at this point, yeah, he's just sort of said, well, no, I can't see your strings either, so I'll refer you for a scan to make sure it's still in place. And I was thinking, well, that might explain the pain. Perhaps it's like embedded somewhere, or it's like trying to migrate out of my uterus kind of thing. These things can happen. So yeah, at the scan a couple of weeks later, like, that was, it was there, it was fine. No, it's still in place, you're fine. So by this point, this is the tricky bit, because I was suicidal. So when I came out of the appointment with the nasty doctor, as I call him, I just said to my partner, like, straight away, like, I've had enough of this. I just want to die. And of course, you know, we'd been together like less than 12 months at this point. He knew this happy-go-lucky, really positive, like, assertive woman who, when I got into these healthcare like settings, I just completely lost all of that and became like this scared, just tired person who just couldn't like advocate for themselves. And he was just like gobsmacked and was just like, what? And I was like, I just want to die. I've had enough. I can't do this anymore. And again, just sobbed for like the entire day. So he'd never seen me like that. And was just like, oh gosh. So he was like, well, we'll go private. And I was like, yeah, but I'll just see the same people. Or like, I had no idea. And then it was a source of luck, really, that somebody from my roller derby team, so I used to play roller derby, so somebody from my roller derby team was nominated for a Chwarae Teg award at the same time as Debbie was, the founder of Fair Treatment for the Women of Wales. And a couple of my teammates had gone to these awards, and Debbie had sort of had to share her story because she'd won like two awards, which I think she hated because she doesn't like any limelight. But, you know, it was amazing. So they were there and they were like, you need to check out this group. Like, it sounds amazing. So I was like, really like fed up and was just like, oh, fine. Join this group, sort of put in this like, can someone help me, please? You know, I've been told, you know, this, that, the other, sort of gave a bit of a potted history. And yeah, in came Debbie with like, this is what you can do. And told me about some specialists in Cardiff that one operated like 9 miles away from my house. So I thought, I've been going through all of this nonsense and being told by these healthcare professionals that no, there's no one else you can see, we're the experts. And they didn't refer me to a specialist, despite the nice guidance that dictates that if there is bowel and bladder involvement in symptoms, a patient should be referred to a specialist. So I didn't know any of that. And yeah, like ended up, again, like I want to talk a bit later about the issues that face us if we can't afford things, but I was lucky. Like I paid £150 to go and see one of these specialists, and it was completely life-changing. Like I went in with like a stack of paperwork and I was like, oh, like absolutely terrified, didn't sleep the night before, despite everyone in this group saying to me, this guy is really nice, you know, he will listen to you, it's going to be fine. And I was like, oh God, you know. And I think that was like the really traumatic thing. You sort of get there and you're thinking, what if this guy is the same as all of the others? What if I get here and he dismisses me? This is the end of the line. And I've already been through the NHS system twice. I've already, but I've lost count of how many times I've been to a GP. Like, what am I going to do? And went in and spent like 60 minutes with one of the most kind men I've ever met in my life, who performed the most gentle examination, considering he had to do a pelvic exam. And that can sometimes, especially with the added trauma of my last sort of exam, the nurse was lovely. They were all lovely. And straight away, he was like, I am convinced that you have extensive rectovaginal endometriosis. I was like, wow, okay. So yeah, like this is the first person in probably, you know, like, it would have been about, yeah, like five or six or seven years that had actually gone like, yeah, I think you've got this disease kind of thing. And yeah, booked me in for a see and treat laparoscopy, which again, I was lucky enough to be able to pay for thanks to help from my family. And yeah, diagnosed them with stage 4 endometriosis that he was absolutely gobsmacked that had been missed and dismissed for so long. Like he just couldn't believe it. So yeah, like after that surgery, I had a little bit of respite for a few months, but then yeah, the symptoms sort of returned. So that was when we were like, this is probably, you know, adenomyosis causing like the lion's share of the symptoms. I tried Prostap for 3 months alongside HRT. That was really interesting. My my daily migraines completely stopped. Generally, I had quite a good time on it, which I know a lot of patients don't. So this is something, again, I would urge sort of healthcare professionals to really research and look at shared decision-making guidelines with their patient. But yeah, like, I suddenly from nowhere, like when my sort of ovaries were shut down, just started bleeding like massively. So all of these symptoms of adenomyosis, I was like, oh, okay, here they are, you know, it's been helping. So yeah, eventually, ended up having like hysterectomy last year. And that was supposed to be, again, quite a straightforward procedure. The specialist said to me, like, I will go in, what we'll do is remove your coil, we'll then remove the uterus, and then if there's any endometriosis there, I'll make sure that's all gone through excision as well. If you've got any squeamish listeners, now is the time to sort of press pause or skip along a bit. He came back to see me like the next day. So, yeah, sort of just before I was ready to go home. And he was just like, oh my word, like, well done. And I was like, what do you mean, well done? He was like, you're such a trooper, like going through all of that. So he said, to start with my, he basically had to do like the surgery in reverse. So my uterus was stuck to my bladder and my bowel. Loath again, like endometriosis just everywhere. So he was gobsmacked again that it just sort of come back so quickly and so, I don't know, violently, I guess. It was like everywhere. So he had to sort of work all of that out. And when he came to then take the coil out, it had actually, like, the adenomyosis was so bad, it had absorbed my coil. So, like, there was almost like no cavity there, essentially. It just completely absorbed it. So he had to cut my uterus up in order to remove it. And then, yeah, sort of again, like, tidy everything up, make sure that all the endometriosis had gone and stuff like that. So again, if nothing else, that really validated my pain because I like telling people for years, like, oh my God, this hurts so much. And it's like all of my organs were like stuck together. And yeah, my coil had been swallowed by my uterus. So yeah, pretty grim. So yeah, very long story. So thank you for bearing with me. But
With us.
that's how we got there.
Thank you for explaining that. I mean, it's hard, with the time that we've got to really demonstrate just how much you've had to go through in all of those years that you've been waiting to find out not only what is wrong with you, but get the treatment that you need. And I think you mentioned a couple of times there about being validated. I mean, what I was hearing is you knew, even if you didn't know to begin with what it could have been, and like you said, and something that I think about myself with my own journey is sometimes you don't know what you don't know. So sometimes I look back and think to myself, actually, would I have known to ask those questions because I didn't actually know that this was not normal? Yeah, like that validation of no, we don't want this, you don't want these diseases.
Nope, absolutely not. And I think that's something, again, if we look at gender bias within healthcare as well, there's often that prejudice. And I think, anyone listening to this, any sort of students listening to this, they will hopefully be thinking, oh, well, no, I'm not like that. It's like, no, you are, right? Let's get it out of the way. We all are. We all have bias. We all have unconscious bias. The really important thing is that we're checking that. So, we don't like everyone that we meet. They always say first impressions count. So if you've got a patient that comes in and they're not your cup of tea, and you're thinking, oh God, it's really important to just take that second and think, right, okay, this doesn't, what I think of this person actually doesn't matter, what is important is that I listen to their symptoms, I listen to their experiences and the impact it's having, and we work out what it is that we're going to do. And I think, like I said, for me, I just felt like there were all these big neon signs pointing to a gynecological condition, at least one gynecological condition. And just because of the bowel involvement, it was almost like we just can't be bothered, just go and see. Like, so I was referred to a gastroenterologist by the NHS nasty doctor. And by the time I'd had like all of my stuff sorted by the specialist in Cardiff, that was before that appointment letter came through. So we're talking about 18 months. So there was no like urgency. Again, like, I know the pressure the NHS is under. And despite all of these experiences, I love the NHS and I will fight for it. And actually, that is that, if healthcare professionals want allies, the best way to do it is actually to listen to experiences like mine and patients like mine and know that we're actually fighting for you as well. We want the NHS to continue. We want it to be free at the point of service. And that isn't just because we probably wouldn't get health insurance because of all of our conditions, but that is like part of a, a reason for that. But you know, we do appreciate it, but actually the thing I bat back to people sometimes is, you know, throughout that 23 years of pain and symptoms, actually how much money and resources was wasted on not helping me or referring me to that specialist when they should have. Like, you know, countless ultrasound scans, despite the fact that we know that ultrasound won't always pick up endo or adenomyosis. You know, blood tests. So this is the thing, like, although I've got all of these conditions that are like inflammation based, like my blood results were always normal. So there were no like inflammation markers in my bloods. I had God knows how many like sexual health screenings, because I was told, so, you know, this could be like pelvic inflammatory disease. You might have like chlamydia that's untreated. It's like, fine, I'll go there. Oh no, I'm clear. You know, came out of like every appointment clear. So, you know, all of that time as well, like, why was it that I was going back and forth to my local gynae saying, can I have a laparoscopy, please? No. Why were those battles there when actually, you know, could that have been done sooner? And again, we know that there are, that, like, unfortunately, there is a skills gap. Like, endometriosis is as common as asthma and diabetes, yet actually training people to see it and to find it and to diagnose it and to treat it effectively, and we're not talking ablation here, we're talking excision, like, you know, there is a skills gap. So it's not all down to like individual healthcare professionals, it's not all down to individual patients. There are whole systemic things here that need to be improved. So yeah, I mean, that's where I was lucky, like you said, about this sort of advocacy, like, would I know what questions to ask? That was like really what helped me finding Fair Treatment for the Women of Wales, because they really helped me with like giving that advice. Yeah, just sort of telling me what I should think about asking, and, you know, just things like getting access to your notes, access to any imaging from your surgeries and things like that. That can be immensely helpful moving forward when you see, you know, a skilled physician then. So yeah.
Yeah, and I've made a note of two things that I really want to ask you.
So yeah, sure.
The other thing I wanted to ask you was, so you mentioned that the cure for adenomyosis is hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder if you're able to tell our listeners how you felt about having a hysterectomy, because obviously that is irreversible.
Yeah.
And it's an operation in itself.
Mm.
But you know, that some people listening might think, you know, that's a really big decision to be making. So how was that for you personally?
Okay, so bit of a disclaimer to start with. I'm very lucky in this sense that I never wanted children of my own. I never wanted sort of biological children. So that in itself was obviously a massive help for me. I hoped that it helps other patients as well, because in terms of asking me questions, there's nothing there that's going to trigger me or really upset me. So for me, like, I think this is one thing I will credit healthcare professionals for, is that I was asking from the age of 19 to have a hysterectomy. I was like, just get it out. Like, I've had enough of this. And of course, a lot of them refused. And some of them refused me because, you know, you will change your mind. You will want children. Your husband will want children. I'm queer, so that's hilarious when people say to me, you know, oh, you know, you're going to, your husband, I'm thinking, what husband? You know, I am in a relationship with a man and he's great, but, you know, that was never something that was like, oh, okay, that has to happen for me, you know? So by the time we got to my hysterectomy, it had been postponed from a couple of months before, because my surgeon had actually injured himself. So that was a bit of a tricky one. But yeah, so by the time we got to like February and day before surgery, I am not even joking, it was like a small child on Christmas Eve. I could not have been more excited. I was obviously quite nervous because, like you say, it's a surgery. You know, these things can go wrong and things like that. So I was trying just to focus on that. But honestly, like, just to have, when I said, like, Mr. Griffith said to me in one of my appointments, is fertility important to you? And I just said no. And I sort of was used to having to back that up. So I sort of said, you know, Dan's got a daughter and she's amazing, but no, I don't want children of my own. And he just went, that's fine, that's good. You know, sort of made some notes. And there was none of that, like, oh, are you sure? Are you 100%? Have you talked to your partner about this? It was just, okay, that helps us, you know, because that gives us an option. I think the thing that I would really like people to understand and learn as well, though, is that, so I had a total hysterectomy, a removal of the uterus and the cervix. People keep calling or referring to a total hysterectomy as the removal of ovaries as well. And it's not. It's like, that is an oophorectomy. Cool name. But yeah, total hysterectomy does not mean you lose your ovaries. So I think I would love more patients and healthcare professionals to really make that clear when they're sort of talking about it, because I've had a lot of assumptions that I'm now in menopause and things like that. As far as I know at the moment, I'm not. Obviously, I don't have periods. So, you know, and because I have other health issues as well. So I have ME and fibromyalgia as well. So, you know, there's a lot of crossover of symptoms. But as far as I know, I'm not in menopause. So, yeah, I think that was sort of something as well. It's just sort of, there was always that assumption, if you have a hysterectomy, that's it. Like, you know, you go into menopause, and that just isn't the case. So, and as well, that's an option now moving forward. If my endometriosis recurs, there's then still the option that I do have my ovaries removed. In the words of, like, my surgeon, he said, I can take them out, I can't put them back in. So if I'd have been really adamant, no, I want, like, my ovaries removed as well, I want all of this, you know, I want to go into menopause, then we would have had a discussion about it. But again, it would have been that shared decision making. So if my choice was an informed choice, I am sure he would have gone along with it, you know. But I think, yeah, that's the thing I'd sort of like a bit more recognition of as well, is that, you know, for me, like, removing this really faulty uterus was amazing. Although, like, my ME, it's mild, but obviously with mild ME, that still is quite an impact. So, you know, I'm limited on how many hours I can work or study and things like that, what activities I can do. But generally, like say, I woke up after that surgery just feeling like 10 times better than I had before I'd gone in. And, like, I still bloat occasionally, but again, like, I've still got a tricky bowel. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that's still kind of there, but actually just having that surgery was life-changing for all the right reasons. Mm.
I'm so glad for you that it has a positive outcome for you.
I think the tricky thing for me is, like, because of the years of, like, medical gaslighting, I will often forget that I've had this diagnosis and that surgery. So I will forget that I've been treated for things. And I will often, like, again, if I'm having, like, any kind of a flare, so, like I say, there can be a lot of crossover. So I don't necessarily think that with my symptoms, you know, now that I've got, like, a recurrence of endo or anything like that, but there's a lot of crossover with my other health conditions. And I'll often still, like, say something to my partner and he'll say, like, remember, you know, you have got that endo diagnosis, you did have a hysterectomy. And I'm like, oh yeah. So that's quite a difficult thing to unpack, I think, is having such major surgery and kind of just forgetting that it happened, or doubting myself that it happened, because I've been conditioned for so many years to doubt all of my symptoms and my existence. So yeah, it's strange.
You know, you've talked in a lot of detail about particularly the physical symptoms and some of those we were talking about earlier, very difficult to share.
Yeah.
They're very personal, they're taboo. And I was just wondering as well about the impact on your mental health, which you did mention a little bit earlier. How has the adenomyosis, your health conditions, but your journey as well, like all of it really, how has that impacted on your mental health?
Mental health now?
Because I know at one point you mentioned that you were in a very good place.
It's a really tricky one. People who meet me and come across me sort of day to day, my friends, my family, like they all know me as like a happy, funny, positive person. I'm quite a sort of social justice warrior, so I get quite angry about things, you know. And I think positively, I've been able to now channel those experiences. I put myself first as well. So during the pandemic, my ME symptoms were like out of control. I was trying to still work. Like at this point, I was working 4 days a week, but I was working for an organization that was working with the UK government on like some of the sort of, support for people during the pandemic. So it was really, really busy. And I was just like, I can't do this. So I quit my job, which was like quite scary. Started doing an MA in creative writing. And now I'm really like just honoured. I work for Fair Treatment for the Women of Wales, the charity who helped me, working 14 hours a week for, you know, because of their design for supporting chronically ill and disabled women and people assigned female at birth, like across Wales, like anytime I need to rest or anytime I'm having a bit of a crisis, like it's just the most flexible organization ever, which is just the dream. I think there are times like if I start having a flare up, I can get quite anxious. I start kind of panicking about these symptoms and like, oh my God, like what's going on? Is it back? It's like this fear. And sometimes it might just be because I've eaten like junk food on the weekend, you know, but other times, you know, it is because of like, so if I overexert myself now, I will often get migraine, I'll get nausea, I'll get bloated, get diarrhea, things like this. So these are actually quite normal symptoms of ME. I can often think, oh God, you know, is the endo coming back? Lately, I've had sort of return of like rectal vaginal pain, which was something that was quite a sort of signature before I got diagnosed and treated. So again, sort of monitoring that. But yeah, in terms of like my mental health now, I think generally it's good, but I do have dips. And like I say, the fact that I gaslight myself and forget that I've had like these surgeries, this diagnosis, it's interesting. I've got a lot lower tolerance now for nonsense though. Like I've had people in my life who should be supporting me who have told other people that I'm making it up and there's nothing wrong with me and that I'm attention seeking and that because I'm so open about it on social media, I'm bragging about all of these illnesses, which like to anyone who's chronically ill or disabled who hears that I hope they will like bitterly laugh with me. But you know, it's just ridiculous because it's like you say, nobody wants to be ill. Nobody wants to have like these things wrong with them. Yet we're like kind of conditioned all the time that, you know, we're just exaggerating and things like that. So yeah, that's been a bit of a challenge, but I've been a bit more confident in kind of cutting those people off because it's like, I just don't have any space or mental space for any nonsense like that now. So I'm probably, yeah, resilient, but without sort of struggles. There are struggles there sometimes for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned a phrase a couple of times, medical gaslighting. I'm just thinking for our listeners, they're not sure what that means.
Yeah,
just explain what that means.
Yeah, sure. So I think there's some quite natural elements to gaslighting, and then there are some quite sinister elements as well. I think one of the more common elements of that gaslighting is, for instance, when we talked before about, you know, those, the normalization of those symptoms, you know, well, that's, you know, that's normal. You know, I think women are conditioned, and in healthcare like settings as well, in a lot of like training, there will be, you know, discussions on pain and things like that. And there'll be an assumption that pain is normal, particularly for women. And the really skilled people I've seen in terms of like, you know, an endometriosis specialist and pain specialist and things, they understand that pain is not normal. Pain is our body telling us that something is wrong. But yeah, the amount of times like I've seen a medical professional and I've talked about pain and they've said it's normal, you know, that dismissal, take some paracetamol, have a hot water bottle, that kind of thing. It's like, I'm already doing that, you know, where like pain relief is really difficult for me now. So despite having had that codeine addiction when I was at university, I think it was, yeah, in the run up to like my second, my first sort of diagnostic surgery, I had an allergic reaction to codeine. I'm also allergic to anti-inflammatories. So during having all of these inflammatory conditions and then being allergic to the things that can actually help. So that's where it's difficult. And I think when I've said to, you know, GPs and stuff, I'm allergic to anti-inflammatories, and they're like, have you actually ever had a reaction? And I'm like, yeah, I was taking ibuprofen, I had an asthma attack, and, you know, the two were like, oh, okay. But yeah, I mean, there's often that sort of dismissal, it's normal, it's normal. Where I think it gets quite sinister is that a lot of women who present with physical symptoms are told that it's in their head. You know, the healthcare professional won't necessarily go as far as saying this is all in your head, but a lot of them actually do. You know, or we'll be told we've got a low pain threshold. You know, it's essentially like a psychological thing. Interestingly, Lara, in my whole 23 years of all of these pain, all of these symptoms, and the amount of times I was told that it was some kind of weakness in my head, you know, or that I was stressed, I was anxious, I was depressed, I was never, ever referred to a psychologist or psychiatrist, ever. So if all of these things are in our head, why aren't we being referred for psychological support, you know? Why is there no sort of mental health support? And that's the thing, I think now as a patient, it's tricky because like at FTWW, we want to see mental health support offered to people with chronic illnesses. What often happens with patients, and again, this is something to kind of warn healthcare professionals about, if you say to your patient, I want to refer you to, you know, have a mental health assessment, it might be that you could benefit from CBT, like cognitive behavioral therapy, something like that. Often they will meet resistance from the patient. And that can be because we feel like we're being dismissed again. And so it's kind of like that defense mechanism, you know, we can be like, no, I just want this, you know, we see like that referral to a specialist as being like the holy grail, whereas actually a lot of the time these other things can help. So I have done CBT. I'm a massive fan of The Chimp Paradox by Steve Peters. I dip in and out of that like all the time. So I love it, and like having that sort of support and finding out ways to manage my reaction to my symptoms. I can't manage my symptoms, but I can control how I react. So like I said, when I get that now, that flare of like anxiety and panic, thinking, oh my god, you know, rather than just I've got tummy pain, I'm like, oh my god, I've got stage 4 endo, it's all really bad again, oh my god, what am I gonna do? It's actually right, I can control my reaction to that. And likewise, again, like I've paid for all of my surgeries since going to a specialist. I also paid for pelvic physiotherapy as well, which was amazing. And again, like I keep, we do advocate to patients, you know, if you've got the opportunity, if you can be referred for, you know, pelvic support as well from a physio, that is really going to help, especially after your surgeries. But yeah, it can be really easy to sort of dismiss those different pathways. But again, you know, I've still not had referrals to like a pain management clinic and stuff like that. Or actually, no, I did once, but again, like the sessions were, I think, 3 hours during the day. And it's like, there's that lack of appreciation that a lot of patients will work throughout, you know, they work, they still have lives. They're not sat at home going, oh my God, it really hurts. Someone help me. You know, we're still trying to function. And actually that's what makes us flipping warriors, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Dee, is there any key messages that you would like to leave our listeners with?
I think for the students, for healthcare professionals listening to this, my plea to you all is to listen to your patients, to really sort of take on board what they're sometimes what they're saying to you and sometimes what they're not saying to you. You know, we've talked about the taboo, the shame. I didn't tell anyone for a long time that I was having rectal bleeding, you know, and I should have felt comfortable to have that conversation, but I think I wasn't really made comfortable during a lot of those appointments. So when I did sort of raise it, you know, it was head down, very embarrassed, very ashamed. And I think I am a very privileged white woman, you know, who's very liberated. I can go and talk about these things. Not everyone is going to be in that position. If you're looking at people from other cultures, if you're looking at people with more complex disabilities, if people are neurodivergent, you know, anything that might actually impact them from being able to communicate with you, that is something, you know, think about how you can encourage them to answer those questions. Can you ask those questions rather than expect them to tell you everything about their symptoms? Yeah, absolutely, like listen and follow the guidelines. You know, I know through now my work with FTWW that my story for a start is not rare. There are hundreds of us, if not thousands of women across Wales who are experiencing similar. They're being refused referrals and things like that. I mean, there's whole other issues with that that we could talk about all day, but you know, if you don't know the answers, that's okay, because we often don't know the answers either. Let's find them together. Let's embrace that shared decision making and, you know, really look to help make that patient's life easier, I think, is what I'd love to sort of implore. For any patients who are sort of listening to this, firstly, you're not alone. It feels very lonely. If you can, in any way, write down all of your symptoms or communicate them with your healthcare professionals and learn about those pathways as well. I think that's something that I kind of beat myself up about a bit now, is that I didn't really do a lot of research. I found out about endo and I was like, oh yeah, I think I've got that, but I didn't really do a deep dive into, okay, what do I do? What should I ask my doctors? What should I sort of look for? If you need support, FTWW, Fair Treatment for the Women of Wales, we have got your back. Like, come and join us. We are having, you know, big conversations with health boards and with Welsh government. So we're actively trying to sort of change the climate at the moment for people. We know that with endometriosis, waiting lists are unacceptably long, in, you know, in excess of 5 years. We know that people are being advised to go private during their consultations with their NHS gynaecs. That's not okay. We all need to change that. And also, if you do have adenomyosis symptoms and you want to find out more, if you Google Adenomyosis Advice Association, it's a really simple, brilliant website. And that was where I found out all of the things that I needed to sort of go back and say, is this what's going on, you know? But yeah, I mean, you're not alone. Yeah. You will get through it. It's not easy, but you will. Again, it's like I said earlier, I appreciate that for me, hysterectomy was a very simple choice. I appreciate that I was able to pay for my surgeries. what I will do always is channel the rage the experiences I've had. I'm channeling that into my work and into advocacy to hopefully change that climate now, so as other people don't have to go through it. That is like my mission now, is that I hope that in, you know, 5-10 years time, we're not still having these same discussions. I will be devastated if we are.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and for those incredibly powerful messages that people can take away with them today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you to Dee for sharing her experience of adenomyosis. For more information on this condition, please go to the Adenomyosis Advice Association or Fair Treatment for the Women of Wales.